This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
If everybody goes home or goes off for the holidays, and in 2 weeks or 3 weeks or a month's time, something hasn't really returned, then we're not going to see progress moving forward. It's very difficult to generate momentum once you've come to a stop.
That's U.S. Institute of Peace researcher Ali Verghi comments on the signing of a new ceasefire between the government and rebels of South Sudan. Details next. Also, Cameroon has denied allegations that its soldiers crossed to Nigeria and attacked villages said to be hosting armed separatist groups. And the UN says thousands of people are fleeing from a fresh wave of intercommunal violence in the DRC's Uturu region. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, South Sudan's government and rebel groups have signed a new ceasefire agreement during a high-level forum to revitalize a 2015 peace deal. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig talks to analysts about the agreement and whether this one will hold when others have not.
A ceasefire is scheduled to go into effect on Christmas Eve in conflict-ridden South Sudan after the country's government and rebel groups, as well as other signatories, signed a cessation of hostilities agreement in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, late Thursday. International Crisis Group senior analyst Casey Copeland says there was a lot of pessimism that the agreement would be signed after both the government and the largest opposition group raised significant challenges to the draft.
Both of those challenges were able to be incorporated. So the government raised issues with the fact that the agreement wouldn't have allowed them to rearm for any other purposes, such as domestic law and order. And the opposition thought that the composition of the ceasefire monitors and the peace oversight body needed to be reviewed in light of changed situations.
U.S. Institute of Peace visiting researcher Ali Verghi says there have been several ceasefire agreements since early 2014. However, he argues that they generally suffer from three main challenges: commitment, verification, and the ability to de-escalate conflict.
The most important of those problems is political commitment. Are the groups that are involved actually committed? So when they say they will immediately disengage, as is specified in this text, do they actually do that? When they say that they will notify everybody under their command of the provisions of this agreement, do they actually take that forward?
Ahmed Soliman, a research associate for the Africa program at Chatham House, emphasizes that for the agreement to hold, South Sudan's neighbors must hold it accountable.
The guarantors of this are going to be the neighbors, the IGAD countries, Uganda, Sudan, Ethiopia, Kenya, others. And without them saying that, you know, there's a risk of punitive measures and that IGAD will pursue those if the parties aren't taking this seriously, then, you know, I see small hope for them, you know, in January when the discussions take place again, leading to positive outcomes.
Verghi argues the success of this agreement will depend upon what happens next.
If everybody goes home or goes off for the holidays, and in 2 weeks or 3 weeks or a month's time, something hasn't really returned, then we're not going to see progress moving forward. It's very difficult to generate momentum once you've come to a stop.
Tens of thousands of people have been killed in South Sudan, and more than 2 million people have fled the country since conflict broke out in December 2013. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Cameroon has denied allegations that its soldiers crossed into Nigeria without permission and attacked the villages said to be hosting and training armed separatist groups. The media had reported that at least one incursion had been confirmed by Nigerian government and military officials, but Cameroon says it only attacked border villages in Cameroon where the armed separatists were hiding and committing atrocities. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Cameroon Communication Minister and government spokesman Issa Chiruma says since President Paul Biya declared war on armed separatists about a month ago, the military has launched many raids on areas along Cameroon's border with Nigeria where their training camps are, but have never crossed over to the neighboring state.
The terrorists had taken advantage of the dense forest at the border with Nigeria to set up secret training camps from which they organized raids against our defense forces. Following the dismantlement operation thus carried out, the hideout of these murderers were literally destroyed and the villages previously taken hostage were liberated.
2 weeks ago, Cameroon said the armed separatists advocating independence for the English-speaking northwest and southwest portions of the country were being trained in Nigeria. Lawan Abagashaga, Nigeria's High Commissioner to Cameroon and special envoy of President Muhammadu Buhari, visited Cameroon's president and said they would collaborate in fighting the terrorists. This week, Reuters and Nigerian local newspapers reported that Cameroon troops had crossed into Nigeria in pursuit of the armed separatists without seeking authorization from Nigeria, causing a fallout between the two governments. Cameroon says it attacked separatist training camps in the three of its border villages around Mamfe and Eyumojok. Ojong Anslem, resident of Eyumojok, says the separatists still gain a lot of support from the borders, even though Cameroon troops are killing many people.
What is now on the streets in the northwest and southwest is sensation.
The UNHCR says the violence has pushed thousands of Cameroonians across the border to Nigeria since October 1, the day the separatists said they had declared their independence and that their humanitarian needs are growing. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The UN Refugee Agency reports thousands of people are fleeing from a fresh wave of intercommunal violence this week in the Democratic Republic of Congo's Ituri region. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency reports more than 2,650 refugees, mostly women and children, have fled to Uganda in search of safety this week. It notes this is five times the usual number of arrivals. The refugees tell aid workers renewed intercommunal violence at Jugu territory have sent them fleeing for their lives. UNHCR spokeswoman Cecile Puyi says the majority of refugees are crossing Lake Albert on rickety fishing vessels. She says many are bringing valuable belongings such as motorbikes and livestock.
Since Monday, there were reports of houses being scorched in the area and people attacked with machetes. More than 20 villages are also reported to have been abandoned due to the fear of reprisals. Refugees report that many more people are waiting to cross, despite the journey's high cost.
Sporadic intercommunal violence between the Hima and Lendu ethnic groups in Ituri, sparked by land disputes, has been going on for decades. Puyi says this latest exodus is putting even more strain upon Uganda, which already hosts some 1.4 million refugees, the largest number in Africa. She says the UNHCR is stepping up its aid for the refugees, but this, she says, is becoming increasingly more difficult to do since the agency has received only 39% of the financing for its operational needs. Puyi says more money is urgently needed to provide shelter and to assist people with special needs. These include unaccompanied children, survivors of sexual and gender-based violence, pregnant women, and people with disabilities. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Uganda will withdraw more than 200 of its soldiers from Somalia by the end of December. Over 6,000 of its soldiers are serving with the African Union Mission in Somalia, or AMISOM. Kampala is responding to calls by the AU and UN for a reduction on the mission soldiers by 1,000 by 31st of December. VOA's Catherine Nambi files this report from Kampala.
The Ugandan military has begun a phased withdrawal of peacekeepers as part of a reduction of the troops deployed in Somalia. Brigadier Richard Kalemire is the Uganda Army spokesperson.
As Uganda, we'd have to cut down about 281 soldiers from the strength we have always had in the mission area.
Kalemire says the phased withdrawal of troops and gradual handover of security responsibilities will be based on the ability of the Somali National Security Forces to ably take over the country's security.
We are still talking about a conditions-based withdrawal from AMSOM, so meaning that there must be a continuous assessment of the situation to determine the appropriate time when the AMSOM mission should wind down. As things stand now, the situation is better, but a bit fragile in some areas, as witnessed by the recent terrorist attacks where hundreds of people died.
Nathan Mugisha is the deputy head of mission at Uganda's embassy in Somalia. He says the AMISOM is training the Somali national forces to take over the responsibility of securing their country once AMISOM forces completely pull out.
The war is almost finished. Good job has been done by AMISOM, but the question is sustainability of this good job. We are working very hard to make sure we develop the capacity of the Somali National Forces to be able to take responsibility of the duties we are doing as AMISOM. The total war will be completed by the Somalis themselves. But the back of the Al-Shabaab was broken. What is remaining is just the Somali National Forces and the people themselves to ensure that they sustain these operations.
Uganda, which was the first country to send troops to Somalia in 2007, is the biggest contributor with more than 6,000 soldiers in the war-torn country. There have been numerous calls for total withdrawal of the Ugandan troops following fatalities. The latest death took place last July when Uganda lost 12 of its soldiers in an ambush by Al-Shabaab terrorists. However, the army spokesperson Kalemire says they will not pull out of Somalia until the country is fully pacified and secure.
We have an ideology that drives us to do these things. We are Pan-Africanists. Where there is a problem, we remain very available to support a process that could lead to peace and stability. So we know the situation in Somalia is not yet fully stable and we still need to be there for some time. There's no situation here in Uganda that warrants us to record those troops there.
The other contributing countries, which are also expected to reduce their presence by December, are Kenya, Burundi, Djibouti, and Ethiopia. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Johannesburg's bus stations are packed with people from all over Africa, eager to leave South Africa's biggest city to spend the holidays with their loved ones. Many of the travelers are Zimbabweans, some of whom will be spending their first ever festivities free of the shadow of Robert Mugabe. The former president was removed by military action about a month ago and replaced by former Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa. Darren Taylor reports.
The holiday rush inside Johannesburg's Park Station. Travellers mull about, waiting for buses and trains. Two of them are husband and wife, Given and Janet Dury, both 32. They shuffle in a long queue. Given's in faded blue jeans, flip-flops, a red cap and a black T-shirt emblazoned with gold letters that read, "Take no prisoners." Janet wears a worn light green dress, a smile that reveals two rows of broken teeth and a belly swollen with their first child. Given says he moved to Johannesburg from Harare 9 years ago to look for work.
I didn't realize I thought there's a life in here, but according to me, I don't see anything else. So you want to go back one day?
Yes, I need to go back, start a new life again in my place.
Given says he's a qualified electrician, but has only been able to find informal employment guarding cars. It's a job he says he hates because it forces him into contact with criminals.
They have come to steal the cars this side, or breaking people's cars windows, stealing the goods inside the car.
The criminals come here, they've got guns, they've got knives, but you guys have got nothing. So what do you do when you see them committing crime?
Most of the time you mustn't come closer to the car. You have to give him that person a little space so that he can run and make a call and tell some other people.
Given and Janet find their seats on the bus. The vehicle's driver plays some modern Zimbabwean music to relax his passengers. It doesn't work. Given explains that his parents died when he was a boy, but he's looking forward to spending Christmas with his siblings in Harare. He says his brothers told him that not much has changed in Zimbabwe's capital since Mugabe disappeared, as he puts it. So, as usual, there won't be any luxuries around for the Dury family on Christmas Day. Given met Janet 5 years ago when she was living rough in Johannesburg.
It's a lot of suffering here if you are a girl, let me say like that.
For Janet, the South African rainbow is as washed out as her husband's jeans. She says she's praying that the Zimbabwean economy will improve so she's able to move back to Harare. Janet says she wishes she had some money at this time of the year to show her husband how much he means to her. At a time when millions of people around the world are relaxing, Janet says all she wants for Christmas is work.
Even if I can get a job, it says you're going to start on January and this date, I will say that's a great, 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 great present for me.
The bus leaves on its 16-hour-plus journey to Harare. The passengers are sweating, some already sleeping. Janet rubs her stomach. Given reads an old newspaper. He flips a page and the headline reads, 2018, what to expect? He studies it intently. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
In other Zimbabwe news, cheers greeted a white farming family today as they returned to their land 6 months after they were forcibly evicted. Robert Smart and his family were the first white farmers to return to land that had been seized by the government of former President Robert Mugabe. Scores of his former employees greeted the family. Starting in 2000, Mugabe began forcing thousands of white farmers off their large holdings in a program he said would redress the inequities of the colonial era. But in many cases, the new owners were Mugabe allies with few farming skills. As a result, thousands of black farm workers also lost their jobs and homes. Many Mugabe critics blame the land seizure policy for ravaging the country's once lucrative agriculture industry. The new president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, says restoring agriculture will be key to his efforts to rebuild Zimbabwe's tattered economy. Egypt and its North African neighbors are facing significant terrorist threats, economic pressures, and political uncertainty. This is a year of regional turmoil draws to a close. From Cairo, VOA's Edward Iranian has more.
Egypt weathered a series of major terror attacks against civilian and military targets in 2017, causing significant loss of life and economic damage. As the Islamic State group crumbles, analysts predict more violence to come. Analyst David Otto of Global Risk International warns that returning jihadis will pose a threat to Egypt and the rest of North Africa.
Because the so-called Islamic Caliphate is collapsing in Syria and Iraq, we will then see a massive return of some of these jihadists who would be able to penetrate within the communities of North Africa, you know, areas like Egypt that has a very strong hold of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Egypt and Tunisia face a spillover of terrorists coming from neighboring Libya, a cauldron of political chaos and terrorism. Both Tunisian and Egyptian security forces have battled Islamic militants, infiltrating often unmarked borders. Rival governments in Libya have complicated the already thorny security situation across vast swaths of the country. The porous border is a problem, but Otto thinks a political solution is key.
Libya, which is very strategic within that region, that acts some kind of like a bridge between that region of North Africa and Central Africa, part of areas like Mali, Chad, Niger, and then towards the Mediterranean in Europe. If we still have this kind of instability within Libya, then it would be difficult for most of these North African countries to be able to deal effectively with the situation.
With 95 million people, Egypt is the Arab world's most populous country, and its security and economic situation has repercussions across both the Middle East and North Africa. A troubled economy represents a huge risk. The country's struggling tourism sector, its old and crumbling industrial base, and the challenge of integrating a mostly young and inexperienced workforce pose serious structural challenges to the government. Democracy activist and commentator Hisham Qasim says that a key problem for the government is how to attract foreign capital.
We have delayed some debts, but not defaulted. But lenders are beginning to look at something. The GDP is not rising, no sources of revenue have been created, and tourism has not picked up.
A big hurdle for Egypt in 2018 are presidential elections. Qasim says they will happen amid a bitter divide between Islamists and liberals, who are not necessarily on the side of incumbent President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi.
On the political front, clearly there is no reconciliation happening in the country. The division is becoming very clear. Sisi supporters versus non-Sisi supporters.
Algeria, the Arab world's second largest country, also faces political and security challenges in 2018, as many expect incumbent President Abdelaziz Bouteflika to run for a fifth term. Like Egypt, Algeria has a large population of young people who feel they have no say in their future. Providing jobs for them, says analyst David Otto, is the most serious challenge for the region's leaders going into 2018.
You have North Africa, which has a growing population of young people who are disenfranchised, young people who are unemployed. So we have to be looking at towards building capacity, towards looking at prevent programs within communities.
If North African countries or their Saharan and sub-Saharan neighbors do not find solutions to the increasing droves of unemployed young people, the ongoing tragedy of refugees trying to flee by sea to Europe is likely to get worse, threatening the stability of Europe and the likelihood of more lives lost at sea. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Skip Sisk, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig into an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.